Good morning. My name is James Magnuson. I'm a senior economics major and a member of the Carleton Conservative Union. And if any of you are interested, there's a Carleton Observers that will be passed out somewhere outside. I'm not quite sure where, but if you want to get a hold of one of those. It's my privilege today to introduce today's speaker, Michael Medved. Mr. Medved is a film critic, a best-selling author, and a nationally syndicated talk radio host. He graduated with honors from Yale and later attended Yale Law School before leaving to serve as a speechwriter in a congressional race. In 1984, he began a 12-year run as co-host of the PBS show Sneak Previews, and in 1993 became the chief film critic for the New York Post. He is the author of 10 nonfiction works, including the influential bestseller Hollywood vs. America. His love of politics has been a constant theme throughout his successful career. After first appearing on and then guest hosting the Rush Limbaugh show, Mr. Medved was given his own show in the Seattle area, which quickly became syndicated. His daily three-hour show now reaches more than 2 million people in 140 markets. Most recently, Mr. Medved collaborated with his wife, Dr. Diane Medved, a clinical psychologist and author in her own right, on Saving Childhood, Protecting Our Children from the National Assault on Innocence. Mr. Medved has been a frequent guest on many major TV talk shows, including Larry King Live, Nightline, Oprah, David Letterman, Good Morning USA, or America, and countless others. His columns on media and society appear regularly in USA Today, where he serves as a member of the Board of Contributors. Please join me in welcoming to Carleton College, Michael Medved.
Thank you very much, and I am delighted to be here, and thanks for arranging this wonderful Minnesota weather for which to celebrate the beginning of what looks to be a wonderful spring weekend. We live in amazing times. We do. I mean, the Scott Fitzgerald, great Minnesotan from St. Paul, once said that the mark of a first-class mind is the ability to hold contradictory messages simultaneously. And that seems to be what we're called on at this moment in history. We are just going through this huge immersion in popomania. There's no other way to describe it. I've never seen anything like it, and I find it quite wonderful. But literally billions of people around the world relating in a very deep and profound way to the work of John Paul II, and celebrating his life and celebrating his message, and people from across every racial and religious and denominational line and national boundary. There are more than 100 heads of state who are present in Rome for this funeral. The heads of state of Syria and Iran are in the Vatican to attend the Pope's funeral. Unbelievable! And the weekend before the Pope's funeral, when the entire world is convulsed with grief and people are turning their lives to mortality and to the ultimate questions, just as the Holy Father would have wanted us to, the number one movie in America is Sin City. What is going on? First of all, how many people here have seen Sin City? Yeah. Let me say, I think that people can agree that Sin City is many things. It is not a festival of family values. This is a movie basically about torture, and in which the good guys are a group of murderous prostitutes, and they're good guys because they help to kill the minions of murderous politicians and religious leaders. There is the first ever appearance that I can remember, and I see a lot of movies. I mean, it's part of my job. There's an appearance of a character who is an original kind of Hollywood hyphenate. He is a cardinal in the Catholic Church slash cannibal who hires Elijah Wood to massacre prostitutes that they eat together and then put the stuffed heads of the prostitutes on the wall like moose heads. This is the number one movie in the country. It made $28 million, almost twice as much as people expected it to make. So the question becomes, what exactly is going on with popular culture? What is going on with what the American people want, with their attitudes toward mass media? Because at the same time that Sin City does wonderfully at the box office, where Desperate Housewives, another film that, doesn't exactly affirm traditionalist values, same time that Desperate Housewives is just a wildly popular show everywhere across the country, red states as well as blue states. At the same time that that happens, there's a new poll today, an NBC News poll by Hart and McInturf. Brand new poll. I was just looking at it moments ago. It's unbelievable. They ask people, what would you like to see Congress concentrate on less? And what would you like to see Congress concentrate on more? Now, the number one thing that people want Congress to spend less time on is steroids and baseball. I think the American people very sensibly assume that there was a certain amount of overkill with the whole world of Washington stopping so people could grill Mark McGuire and Rafael Palmeiro for a couple of hours. The second thing they want people to do less of in Congress is concentration on Terri Schiavo. Well, given the fact that she's no longer alive, probably people will get their wish as far as that's concerned. So what do they want people to spend more time on Congress? Number one, the environment. Okay? Number two, they want people to spend more time on eliminating sex and violence in the media. Okay, what exactly is going on? I mean, number one movie is Sin City. The most influential new TV show in years is Desperate Housewives. And overwhelming majorities of people say they want less sex and violence in the media. If you remove the sex and violence from Sin City, it would be a 3-minute movie. Okay? It just wouldn't be able to function. By the same token, there's a new cover story of Time Magazine. You may have seen it. The cover story has the headline, "Has TV Gone Too Far?" And 70% of people think it has. They think there needs to be less harsh language, less nudity, less graphic sex, less violence on TV. And then the same survey in the same issue of Time Magazine says 66% of people think the FCC overreacted to the Janet Jackson affair. People are deeply confused and they're deeply conflicted. And I want to suggest to you that there are reasons for these conflicts. There are reasons for this confusion. And the reasons have to do with three deliberate lies with which entertainment apologists have infected the American consciousness. There are three lies that come up whenever you talk about any issues of media and values. And those three lies are, number one, it's just entertainment. It doesn't influence anybody. So relax and shut up. Lie number two, we just reflect reality. We don't shape reality. And lie number three, Hollywood just gives the public what it wants. How many people here have heard one or all of these statements or excuses in conversations about mass media? Well, of course, they're very, very common. I want to go over why each one of these lines is in fact a lie, and then take your questions and comments and maybe engage in some Carlton-style give and take. Okay, first of all, the lie that says that it's just entertainment, we don't really influence people at all. My new book, which was released a couple of weeks ago, is called Right Turns, Unconventional Lessons from a Controversial Life. And one of the lessons that I talk about in Right Turns is the fact that there is a schizophrenia and hypocrisy at the very core of the American entertainment industry that occasionally comes out in a very, very glaring way. Let me give you an example which will focus the attention on this first lie. After this book came out, Hollywood versus America, I was invited to a lot of different forums of Hollywood producers and things of that nature, sort of to be the skunk at the garden party, you know, Banquo's ghost, who is going to sort of shake his gory locks at the producers and say, nyah, 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 in any event, and also so they can beat me up rhetorically. And I was participating in one such forum, and I was on the stage with literally five heads of the 9 major studios. There were 5 of the 9 major studios represented by the studio heads. And I had gone up and given my normal rap about how there needs to be more accountability and responsibility on the part of people who deal with entertainment programming. And the head of one of the major studios got up after me and he said, "Well, the problem with Michael Medved and people of his ilk, whenever you're labeled as part of an ilk, you know you're in trouble." I mean, ilk is just one of those words. It's just not good. He says, "The problem with Michael Medved and his ilk is that they give us all kinds of criticism and blame for the occasional bad things we do, but we don't get any credit for all the good things we do. For instance, you don't hear Michael Medved give us credit for the fact that our movie, Lethal Weapon 3, saved thousands of American lives." And people applauded. So I'm sitting here, and I'm thinking, Lethal Weapon 3? You know, I mean, it's a different kind of passion for Mel Gibson. You know, I'm trying to figure out how... Okay, so I got up, I had a rebuttal period, and I said, "With all due respect, I've been sitting here thinking, and I can't figure it out. You mentioned that Lethal Weapons 3 saved all these innocent people. How did that work?" And the head of the studio who had authorized the project said, "It's very simple. Everybody knows. Everybody here knows." They applauded. In Lethal Weapon 3, before Danny and Mel, that's Danny Glover and Mel Gibson, go off on a high-speed chase, we show a close-up of the two of them fastening their seatbelts. Now, just think about this for a moment. We're talking about a movie. This particular movie was 2 hours, 10 minutes long. Okay? In that 2 hours and 10 minutes, there are countless explosions and gunfights and knife fights and eviscerations and lacerations and people bopping each other. The assumption here is nobody's going to imitate that. No, nobody's going to imitate that. But the literally 4 seconds of Mel and Danny fastening their seatbelt, that people will imitate. That people are going to pay attention to. This is absurd. This is ridiculous. There are Hollywood Environmental Media Awards that are given out every year where they give these big awards, and Hollywood loves awards, where they give awards to people because in the midst of some stupid TV sitcom, they show someone recycling. Or they will show in the bedroom of a teenage character's home, they'll show a little poster about Save the Rainforest. You get an award for this. But the idea is that it's so influential, these few seconds of media, that it can change people's behavior. But the rest of the content, involving every kind of very often totally irresponsible sexuality, every kind of graphic violence, that no one will imitate. How absurd this is. How ridiculous this is. Planned Parenthood used to give out awards for condom scenes. You know, I understand it's very nice they have condom scenes in motion pictures and on TV, showing people engaging in safe sex and responsible sex. But think about this. People are told that showing someone deploying this talismanic prophylactic, right, is going to inspire imitation all over the country. Young people, oh, now everybody will use condoms. But if you dare to say that people might also imitate the behavior that makes the condom necessary or appropriate, oh, that not. Nobody's imitating that. Nobody follows that. It's absurd. It should be very obvious to everyone, and everyone in Hollywood knows it. And if you ask them and you push them, of course they'll acknowledge it. Yes, it is entertainment, but it's not just entertainment. Entertainment sends messages. There is no such thing as message-free entertainment. Doesn't exist, has never existed. Famous movie in 1933, before most of you were born, before even I was born. 1933, the Oscar-winning movie, number Best Picture of the Year, was It Happened One Night. And in It Happened One Night, there's a famous scene where it shows Clark Gable going to bed, and he's in a motel room, and because it's 1933, Claudette Colbert is on the other side of a sheet. They call it the Walls of Jericho, because they're not going to sleep together in the same motel room. They're going to be a different side of the sheet. In any event, Clark Gable is shown taking off his shirt. And he's not wearing an undershirt. Literally, this is provable, it's part of Hollywood history, sales of undershirts, of t-shirts, went down over 30% that year. And people attributed it directly to Clark Gable. They pay millions of dollars for product placement. You know what product placement is. You know, in the middle of a movie, all of a sudden you see someone holding a Coke can toward the camera. And maybe they don't say, oh, things really do go better with Coke, but you see the can, you see the label. All these companies pay for that. The idea that a few seconds of flashing imagery can change people's behavior. And look at advertising. Advertising on TV is a billion-dollar industry. And they can sell everything in ads from pet food to politicians, and even politicians who resemble pet food. And it is regularly sold, and it works. You know, advertising, they don't give money to advertising agencies and networks as a charitable endeavor. It's not an eleemosynary institution. They give money to these commercials because they work. It changes human behavior. It can get you to buy a different brand of floor wax, a different brand of car. It can get you to buy a different brand of politician. Now, how can you suggest, how can you possibly suggest that 30 seconds of flickering imagery on a cathode ray tube or on a flat screen is going to sell, change, alter human behavior in terms of buying decisions, even political decisions, but the 30 minutes surrounding the 30 seconds, that has no influence at all. That sends no messages at all. It's totally absurd. But that brings us back up to the one sort of sub-lie that is always used to support the big lie number one. It's just entertainment, doesn't influence people at all. And that lie will be, well, you know what? People are all worried about violence in the media. They're all worried about sexuality in the media. And hey, look at me. I've watched a great deal of this violent stuff. I love Sin City. I love the violent material. I love the sexualized material. And I'm a good, fine, upstanding citizen. I haven't murdered anybody in a long time. I've been faithful to my wife, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't influence me, so that proves it doesn't influence anybody. Now, people here who take logic courses or who understand logic will understand how profoundly illogical this is, even though it has a surface appeal. And let me break the logic down for you. How many people here have ever seen a TV ad for, say, a TV ad or heard a radio ad or some kind of media ad for Jaguar automobile? Yeah, nearly everybody. How many people here drive a Jaguar? Anybody? Well, you can admit it if you do. It's a nice British car. Okay, so using the logic of Hollywood apologists, that shows the Jaguar ads don't work, right? You all saw them. The ad goes out to millions of people. Nobody buys the car. You didn't buy the car. All these people. So it shows the ad doesn't influence anybody. It's absurd. They know it doesn't influence everybody. The fact that an ad or a message or violence in the media doesn't influence everybody does not mean that it doesn't influence anybody. You see, all they need to do to change their corporate profile is to influence one out of, say, 200,000 or 300,000 people who see the ad. And in terms of violence or very destructive sexual behavior, you don't need to influence everybody the same way. Most people won't be influenced. They won't. But if you influence a small number of people, the problem of criminality in this country is not a widespread problem. It is concentrated. There are a few people who engage in criminal activity all the time. And by the way, all kinds of research shows that those people usually consume more than average levels of media, particularly of television. And there's something else. Even those people who don't buy the car have been influenced by the Jaguar ad. Because the Jaguar ad helps to define for you the notion that this is a luxury car, it's elegant, it's sexy, it's stylish, it's hip, it's contemporary. Otherwise, you know, who cares? But you see, and that's the way that media can also influence people, even those who don't imitate what they see on screen. It redefines what is sexy. It redefines what is glamorous. It redefines what is desirable or even normal. And we are all influenced in ways that we may not even acknowledge by what we see on the screen. And that brings me to the second big lie. The second big lie is the one that says, you know what? We don't simply shape reality. We merely reflect reality. We show the world as it is. And in one of the other debates that I've engaged in over the years, I used to do a TV show on British TV. And during the time that I was doing that, I ended up engaging in a debate with Paul Verhoeven, who used to be a very important director. He directed RoboCop. He directed Basic Instinct, which I had reviewed for the New York Post under the headline, Basically It Stinks. And Mr. Verhoeven basically killed his career with a movie called Showgirls, which some of you may have had the misfortune of seeing. In any event, Paul Verhoeven, who is a former mathematics professor from Holland, was on the air with, and he says, Michael Medved talks about media like the Nazis talk about media. Yeah, no, I don't really think so. Actually, my grandmother and my mother were refugees from Nazi Germany. But he went on and he said, what he doesn't understand is it's our job to hold the mirror up to nature. And if you see that there's a face in the mirror that's ugly, then you don't break the glass or blame the mirror. You try to beautify the face. And this also sounds very good, right? I mean, basically it's the job of mass media to reflect American reality. The only problem is that what you see on the screen is nothing like the real world. Maybe one of the best ways to understand that has to do with the issue of violence, for instance. According to the Annenberg School of Communication at University of Pennsylvania, they did a famous analysis of primetime TV. If you look at primetime TV and you include cable as well as the major networks, you will see about, an average of 7 murders a night. All right? And that's out of a total of about 350 characters that you meet. So there is a murder rate every night of 7 out of 350. That reflects reality? I mean, if we had a murder rate of 7 out of 350 people a night, then you can do the math. I mean, it would be a couple of months, and then we wouldn't need zero population growth because there would be zero population. Every single person in America would be dead if we had that murder rate after 2 months. And the last one left alive could turn off the TV. I mean, it's absurd. Sexuality. Planned Parenthood, not known to be a conservative organization, did an analysis of TV programming a couple of years ago where it showed that TV programming on every single network showed intercourse and sexual activity very, very frequently. There are 30,000 incidents of sex in prime time in the given year they measured. The ratio of sex outside of marriage to sex inside marriage was 14 to 1. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I know many of you are not married, okay? But trust me on this, this does not reflect reality. The biggest sex survey ever done in the United States was done at University of Chicago in 1994 by the National Opinion Research Center. It was the biggest sex survey ever, famous sex survey, made the cover of Time magazine. In that sex survey, they found that at every age, every single age, not only did married people have more enjoyable sex than single people, they had sex more often. It is a simple matter of convenience, if you think about it. I mean, and I can assure you that this study shows that married people in their 20s have sex more often than single people in their 20s. Married people in their 30s have sex more often than single people in their 30s. And I guarantee you, married people in their 80s have sex more often than single people in their 80s. It's very, very consistent. And yet this is not shown on TV. Or let me give you another example. The Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, GLAAD, gives out awards every year for gay role models on TV and gay images on TV. And by most analyses now, you have on primetime TV between 35 and 50 regular gay characters, most of whom are drawn very affectionately. And this is seen to be great progress in American diversity and representation of reality. Okay? How many evangelical Christians do you see on TV? Other than when they want a convenient murderer? I mean, think about it. Think about it. There's a new show coming out with Bill Pullman called Revelations, in which he, in which apparently there is a nun who's played by Natasha McElhone. But basically, clergy, serious religious people, are invisible. Now, let me just give you an indication. At the last election, they had exit polling, and people pay a lot of money for this exit polling. It's supposed to be very good, okay? It's basically a very accurate reflection of people who voted. In the last election, 4% of all people who voted identified themselves as gay or bisexual. 4%. 42% identified themselves, 42%, as born-again Christians. Now, I'm sorry, TV does not give you a vision of reality in terms of religion, violence, sexuality. Basically, what's going on in America? It is a mirror, yes, like director Paul Verhoeven said, but it's a funhouse mirror. It's twisted. It reflects certain imperatives of the medium. And one of the imperatives of the medium is not to show, quote, normal life. The whole idea of television, the whole idea of movies, is to show drama. And drama, by its nature, is conflict. But what you get as a result of the emphasis on conflict is a terribly, terribly distorted view of what is actually going on in the United States of America. It leads to a syndrome that I talk about in my new book as the I'm okay, you're not syndrome. If you look at polling data time and time and time again, you'll see people who will tell you, are you happy with your job? Very happy with my job. Ask people, are you happy with your marriage? 94% of married Americans say they're happy with their marriages. Over 89% say they would marry the same person again. Okay? Which is kind of reassuring. And yet, then when you ask people, what's the status of marriage in America at large? Similar percentages in the 80s think marriage is in trouble. Okay? We don't have a 50% divorce rate. That is another media lie. And a statistical lie. You can ask me about that in the question period. But the emphasis on dysfunction gives the lie to this whole claim that media, oh yeah, they just hold up a mirror to nature. It reflects the trends in our society. It does not. It reflects some trends, not others. And it creates some trends that don't really exist in reality. And that brings me to the third question. The question that says, the lie that says, we just give the public what it wants. Now, here, you'd think, well, it should be very persuasive. I mean, these are businesses, the TV networks and the big movie studios. They're very, very big businesses. They're for profit. They tend to make very big profits. So how can you say they don't give the public what it wants? I'll tell you one secret that you have to keep in mind to understand what's going on in mass media. American media companies used to serve America, and they used to sell most of their product to the United States and to rely upon audiences in the United States for most of their profit. The most recent figures, and it came out just a couple of weeks ago, the National Association of Theater Owners in Las Vegas, Nevada, the most recent figures show 70% now of the revenue stream for the big media companies, big film companies, comes from overseas. American people have been rejecting movies for a long time. The last 2 years, despite lies, the big lie that they bring out is, oh, it's the best year ever for movies. Oh, my, more money than ever before. Only because of the rise in ticket prices. If you talk about the number of people who are actually sitting in movie seats, it's gone down sharply each of the last 2 years. And the overall trend is shocking. Despite the fact that America is just about double the population we had in 1965, almost double the population we had in 1965. In 1965, close to 40 million people went to the movies every week. Today, with almost double the population, about 20 million people, go to the movies every week. Now, a lot of these changes have to do, and every survey shows this, and people in the National Association of Theater Owners will say this, has to do with people rejecting some of the emphasis on violent and profane and sexualized content. Nearly a third of Americans don't go to see a single movie in the course of a year. That should be a huge targeted audience. How do we get those people back to movies? But those people have been largely ignored. Another statistic, and this literally just came out. It came out last month. It was made a front page of USA Today. If you take a look at the relative box office take for movies rated R, adults only, or movies rated PG, which tend to be aimed at family audiences, which kind of movies, leaving out PG-13 for a moment, which kind of movies do better at the box office? Somebody says R, somebody says PG. Well, it's really kind of not close. PG movies, on average, literally do 5 times more at the box office than R-rated films. And yet R-rated films still represent 63% of all releases in 2004. This is insane. In this book, in Hollywood versus America, I laid out the statistics covering 20 years, showing every single year PG does better at the box office than R, PG-13 does better at the box office than R, even G does better at the box office than R. And yet they continue grinding out these R-rated films. You know why? Because that's what gets the good reviews. If you look at the films that actually win Oscars, get nominated for, and win Oscars, win Critics Award, they tend to be R-rated movies, and most people in Hollywood, believe it or not, care more about Oscar gold than box office gold. If you talk to some kid in film school who's getting ready to go out and go into the marketplace, he wants to be Martin Scorsese. He wants to be Woody Allen. Now, Martin Scorsese and Woody Allen are both flop directors. Neither one of those guys makes hits. They don't make money. They continue working because they're both geniuses. And because there is a tremendous desire on the part of insecure people and an insecure industry to win the respect of your peers and the acclaim of your peers. And that acclaim is heaped upon people not based on how much money you make, but based upon, of course, everybody wants to make money. But even more than you want money, you want acclaim and respect and adulation. So I've talked about 3 big lies. The lie that says doesn't really influence anybody. The lie that says just reflects reality. And the lie that says it's just giving the public what it wants. How do you respond to 3 lies? You respond to lies with the truth. With knowing the truth, with speaking the truth, and as far as possible, with living the truth. Let me give you a suggestion very quickly about responding to each of these 3 lies, and then I'll open it up to your questions. On the first lie, the lie that says it doesn't really influence anybody, yeah, it influences everybody. The average American spends 29 hours a week watching television. It now turns out that guys, on average, spend a gigantic amount of time with video games. Okay, we know that. Everybody knows that. How is it possible that you can spend more time watching TV as a child and a teenager, more time watching TV than you will spend in a classroom? Because you don't take vacations from TV, you do take vacations from classrooms. And you assume that you'll be influenced by what you hear in class, but you're not going to be influenced by the world's greatest persuaders and what they put on TV. Of course you're influenced. So the answer to the lie that says, no, it doesn't influence anybody, is to recognize that it does. And to become a discerning consumer. And to think for just a moment before you decide, I'm going to watch this show, or I'm going to rent this DVD, or I'm going to go out to this movie, think for just a moment about the way that this particular piece of entertainment is likely to change your life. Everything we do, every moment, moves us in one way or another. Life is precious. It's important. And to not ask questions about the substance and the impact of what we put into our minds and our imaginations and our very souls through media consumption is even more idiotic than not thinking about the nutritional value or the caloric value or the impact on us of what we put in our mouths to eat. Brings us to the second lie, the lie that says it just reflects reality. It doesn't reflect reality. And everybody should remember that at all times. Don't believe that the world that you see on TV is true or accurate. Most people have an instinctive sense of that. But what you have to keep in mind very specifically is that in general, what you are seeing on TV, what you see in the movies, is a reflection of reality in the direction of dysfunction. Didn't used to be that way. Hollywood used to specialize in the Great Depression. They made all these glamorous movies with Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers gliding together over polished marble. They would make a vision of reality that was prettier than the harsh reality of an America where one-third of the people were unemployed and people were living in Hoovervilles and people were suffering. Today, however, the world that you see on TV and at the movies tends to dis-normal life, to emphasize the bizarre and the dysfunctional. And that should be kept in mind whenever you are processing this information or consuming entertainment. And the third issue, the one that says we just give the public what it wants, what truth do you need to answer that particular lie? The truth that says that really consumers are powerless to control the release schedules from these major companies. That's particularly true because they're so dependent upon consumers abroad who actually like a negative vision of America much more than consumers at home do. So what does that mean? That means that all of these people who are out there organizing boycotts and talking about financial pressure, it's a waste of time. I know these people. When you announce we're going to boycott, we're going to petition drive, we're going to oppose some kind of company, it's laughed at, or it encourages the company. The stuff doesn't work because it's not about the money. It's about pleasing your peers and impressing your peers. So what does that mean? What's the truth you take out of it? The truth you take out of it is you only control one movie release schedule, the schedule of what you choose to see. You only control one television schedule, the schedule of what you choose to turn on. What we need in the world of media is more emphasis on demand-side solutions rather than supply-side solutions. More emphasis on what we take and less worrying about what Hollywood makes. You can't eliminate the influence of media in general, but you can certainly temper it on yourself. And in this regard, let me conclude with this. Everyone in this room is probably very busy with the demands of classes at Carleton and very busy lives. And I would imagine, like college students everywhere, you probably watch very little TV. I mean, all of the studies show that kids watch a great deal of TV in high school. You go into college, and the TV watching goes way down. If you want, I'll tell you the figures. The figures are 27 hours a week for the average high schooler, 10 hours a week for the average college student. But then guess what happens? As soon as you graduate from college, pew, zooms right back up, especially people who are living single lives end up watching 30 hours a week of TV and more. My injunction to you is don't do it. Don't do it. Because the real problem with mass media is not low quality, though God knows the quality is low. The real problem is high quantity. Because I don't care if you're spending 29 hours and 4 minutes a week watching PBS or C-SPAN, Fat Chance. It still is not a good investment of your time. It's a beautiful world out there. There's so much to do. If you manage to cut back on 1/2 hour of TV per day, less than the national average, that's giving you extra years of life. It gives you an extra 15 hours a month to do that exercise program you've been meaning to do, to spend time with your friends, to spend time with family, to learn that foreign language, to learn that musical instrument, to take up painting, to read a good book. I have several of them that I'd like to recommend. It gives you an opportunity of 15 extra hours a month to live. And in a glorious springtime, in a season of new life and rebirth and of joy, it gives you an extra 15 hours a month just to go out there and to revel and to relish this glorious world that the good Lord has given to every one of us. Thank you very, very much for your attention. Thank you. We have a little bit of time for some questions. Yes, sir, in the red shirt.
You say that one of your main issues with media is that you think it's infected with lots of negative social networks. But I've taken a whole bunch of media studies classes here, and I know that doesn't put me up on the same level as you, the critic, the person on TV. But we learned that sort of this hypodermic style of dress, which you described as infection, sort of an outmoded way of looking at media, and it's sort of a negotiation between the producers of media and the consumers of media, and that when people are watching TV, they're not necessarily like just absorbing everything, they're sort of taking it into their head, having a dialogue with themselves, and also with what's going on the screen. So I was wondering, how do you sort of come to terms with that?
First of all, let me repeat what he's saying. He's saying that it's not a simplistic thing like people monkey see, monkey do. People don't have a theory of media. I made it very clear, if you listen to me, that I have never ever written about or claimed that the majority of people who see mass media imitate it or are even profoundly affected by it. What is undeniable is the truth of what you're saying. He said that people, when they're watching TV, are not paying close attention or taking notes or falling down like a lot of little automatons to become just like the people they see on TV. Of course not. It is a steady drip, drip, drip. It is accumulated. People who work in advertising, which is a huge industry, will tell you that seeing one advertising impression does almost nothing. You have to have several impressions before you change your point of view of that Jaguar. And that's what happens on television. And that's what happens in mass media. And if the messages in TV and in feature films weren't so enormously similar, then it would be less of a concern. The concern, again, is not that people are going to be exactly like what they see on TV. They can't be. But the concern is that on a whole range of issues, mass media defines for us what we think is going on in the world at large. Dr. George Gerbner at University of Pennsylvania writes about the mean world syndrome. That people assume that things are much worse off in the United States because of their watching entertainment media and because of their watching of TV news. We don't have a TV news business. We have a TV bad news business. I mean, basically everything, like today, I couldn't believe it. Today, other than the Pope, he's still dead. Other than the Pope's funeral today, which was, of course, a huge subject, and I think that's appropriate, there's a football coach who was shot in Texas. Why is this news? Why is it news? It's because it's sensationalistic, but it gives the people, most Americans are unaware that the rate of violent crime in this country has actually gone down very greatly. They're unaware of the good news. The real influence of media is not influencing behavior, as in violent crime. The real influence of media is creating in people's minds an unduly negative view, a constant state of crisis and of decline in a country which, by honest measures, has really been doing pretty well for the last 20 years. I beg pardon? When you say my friends at Fox, I am not now, nor have I ever been an employee or had anything to do with Fox. And by the way, I think TV news is disgusting. And I don't exempt Fox News by any means, but it's all disgusting. And as a matter of fact, it's something I write about extensively in Right Turns in my new book. I have lived in a TV-free household since I went away to college at 16. We don't have a TV. Our kids have been raised without TV. And I don't think that, Fox News is the answer to anything in particular. Yes, sir.
Yeah. You sort of mentioned the Holocaust earlier, and I just want to see if I can use it as an example. So let's say there are more movies about the Holocaust than movies about other things that have happened longer, or the Holocaust is overrepresented in our media, let's say. Can you speak to the potential value of that as examining ourselves or our period in history that we don't want to understand, that it might be overrepresented because we want to know something about it, or
Okay, interesting question. What he's asking about, he's asking about if I didn't say anything like this, but if I believe that the Holocaust is overrepresented in movies, or there's too much emphasis on the Holocaust, could that be because it's something we need to examine and that we want to know something more about? There's no question at all that there has been a disproportionate emphasis recently on the Holocaust, and partially that's compensatory. It's because at the time that the Holocaust was actually occurring, and when Hollywood could have done something to alert people to some of the dangers, Hollywood never touched the subject. They were afraid to, because they didn't want to lose the market in Germany, and they didn't want to be accused by anti-Semites of using Jewish influence in Hollywood to drive a Jewish agenda. So you had virtually nothing from Hollywood. I mean, nothing about the Holocaust until after the 1960, 15 years after the killing was over. And so now we have it all the time. The reason I say it's so disproportionate is, look, those of you who have studied contemporary history know very well Stalin killed more people than Hitler. They're both monsters, but one monster we pay a great deal of attention to, the other monster basically gets a pass. And it's one of those things that you see it all the time. People do not understand in this country, because of media imagery, and it's a very good example of the influence. Right now, no one would say, well, you know, the Nazis went too far, but I understand, and I'm sympathetic to people who were sincere Nazis. Right? No one would say that. But people say it all the time about communists. Jane Fonda was just on TV. She is peddling her autobiography. It's called My Life So Far. And she said, you know, I was horrified and terribly hurt when my father said to me, her father, Henry Fonda, Jane, if you ever turn communist, I'd turn you into the government. Now, why should she be offended by that? What if he had said, if you ever turn Nazi, I'll turn you into the government? Of course he would. You should. If you identify with a system of monstrous evil that is responsible for 100 million dead bodies in the 20th century alone, then obviously you have betrayed your country, you've betrayed your family, and you deserve to be turned into the government. And that was exactly what he was talking about. And yet people don't understand that, because can anyone here think of a movie, even one, about Stalin's Holocaust? Yeah, British film. Good film with Tom Tryon. One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. British film. American film? There's none. Really, there's none. There are some international co-productions. There's one called The Inner Circle, which is a pretty good movie with Tom Hulce. But nothing big, nothing even vaguely equivalent to Schindler's List or Playing for Time or any of the many, many movies made about the Nazis. And that, it seems to me, is an indication of the way that movie imagery can help determine the emotional reaction and the viewpoints of Americans on a historical / social political issue. We have time for a few more questions. A gentleman in the back there, in the gray.
Me?
Yep.
Excellent. Your argument is that the solution for a lot of the problems that you identify is demand side, not supply side.
Right.
But given the issue of, say, the news media, for example, where the alternative is to turn it off instead of to watch, it seems that the alternatives then become to try and be informed and weigh what news is being presented, or to be completely uninformed.
Not at all. Not at all. Let me say, when I say to turn off news, I mean turn off TV news. I want you to listen to radio, especially AM 1280 every day. Here in Minnesota, we're on every day from 2 to 5 live. And in fact, I'm going to be doing my show back in Minneapolis after I'm done here. But leaving aside radio, look, my big line on this is the average American viewer watches about 40 minutes of news every night. It's quite typical. In that 40 minutes, you can read both the New York Times very carefully and, to get the other side, the Wall Street Journal. And you can usually throw in USA Today, which only takes a few minutes to read after you read my column very carefully. But you are so vastly better informed. Newspapers, and particularly even the stuff on the internet, the written word is a vastly, vastly better means of getting information than television, partially because television, and those of you who have taken communications classes like this gentleman right here know this, 70% of the television communication is visual. It's not verbal. People are responding to imagery because that's what influences people psychologically. That's what sinks in. And that's why TV news profoundly misinforms people. Sometimes people say seeing is believing. Well, it shouldn't be believing. If you read those newspapers, you read, again, both the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, you'll be getting two sides, different perspectives, and vastly more detailed and better reporting, and it's the same investment of time. Okay, let's take two more questions quickly, and then, gentlemen right here.
Question, is there a structure that is set up that is preventing the kinds of movie and the kinds of entertainment that you would like to see being presented? I mean, you've talked about dollars and cents. You said it doesn't make sense from an economic point of view. That means that there should be a whole bunch of movies out there with evangelical Christians in them.
No, of course there should be. And there are attempts. By the way, things change in the end. What he was saying was, is there a structure in place that prevents the kinds of movies that I would like to see from being created? And the answer is yes and no. I mean, look, the studio system, the big companies that own these major media, it is a surprisingly self-enclosed system. There's a good book called The View from Sunset Boulevard by Ben Stein. It's a classic book about the attitudes of the people who actually create this entertainment. You know, there are reasons. Hey, you ever thought about this? America's evenly divided, right? Politically, about half Republicans, half Democrats. I mean, maybe Carlton is not quite so evenly divided. And it is a great honor to be speaking at a university that was so closely identified with the late Paul Wellstone. But so I understand Carlton is not evenly divided, but America is. But Hollywood looks a lot more like Carlton than it does like America. It makes no sense. And partially it's because it's a self-selecting group, but it's also an exclusivist group. It is in the process of change. One of the huge forces for change, whether you like it or not, is Mel Gibson. The Passion of the Christ made $370 million domestic. It is the top money-making R-rated film in history. In history. And by the way, the only R-rated film in the box office top 10 last year. So right now there are a number of companies that are trying to work outside the system. The problem is distribution. Some of those companies have had great success. People don't know this, but the movie Ray that won the Academy Award for Jamie Foxx was made by a specifically Christian film company and was made partially because of its redemptive messages. That same company is now working on C.S. Lewis's The Chronicles of Narnia in a very, very big production that should be interesting. So I believe that like any other system, like any other top-down control, command and control system like the old Soviet Union, it takes a while for things to change. But now that we have a two-party system in Russia and Albania and maybe in Hollywood sometime too, a lady in the turquoise.
What do you think is the proper role of sexuality and violence and profanity? And can we consider those things, even though they aren't exactly reflected in their proper proportion in mass media, can we consider those things separate from the context of the drama which is being shown?
An excellent question, and of course not. The question was, what's the proper role in media of profanity and violence and sexuality? And can we consider them outside the context of the drama in which they're presented? And of course we can't. I think that Saving Private Ryan is one of the finest films ever made in Hollywood. I think it's a remarkable film. It's also hugely profane. A lot of uses of the famous F-bomb. And it's one of the most violent films ever made. The Passion of the Christ is one of the most violent films ever made. And there's very few films. Passion of the Christ is more brutal and sadistic in its own way than Sin City. But I think The Passion of the Christ is a great film, precisely because of the context of the violence. People can say rightly that Shakespeare is highly violent. I mean, if you have seen Titus Andronicus is sort of Shakespeare's version of Sin City. I mean, it's really got a lot of the same themes, including cannibalism. And Hamlet, they've got bodies all over the stage. The difference is the context. And whether the violence is there for the purposes of glorification and exploitation, or whether it is there to serve a deeper purpose in the storytelling.
How is Hamlet different from Million Dollar Baby?
How is Hamlet different from Million Dollar Baby? Well, one is a great drama and one is a piece of crud. And I think Million Dollar Baby is an enormously clumsy movie. Hamlet doesn't rely on narration, okay? Henry V does, but Hamlet doesn't. And if anyone wants to compare the narration in Henry V, oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention, you want to compare that to the unbelievably pedestrian and poorly written and flat-footed narration they wrote for Morgan Freeman in Million Dollar Baby? And by the way, Hamlet also does not at any point glorify suicide, which, by the way, Sin City also does. And I have problems with the refusal of the makers and marketers of that movie, Million Dollar Baby, to acknowledge that the movie was sending a message that the ultimate act of love is to help someone die. Now, you may agree with that message. A lot of Americans do. But to sell the movie as Rocky in a sports bra without acknowledging that it has a very, very strong death with dignity theme, it seemed to me to be effectively dishonest, aside from the fact that I think that other than Hilary Swank's performance, it was an extremely pedestrian film. We really should... last question very quickly, and then we have to knock off.
So one of my theories about this is that, I mean, a lot of great media, both in books and in film, has been banned in some contexts. And I've often thought that this has been sort of an ideological, conscious inference, where, instead of looking at the truth, which is that things that are valuable and provocative often do offend, they've taken it the other way around and said, if it can offend, your average middle-class American, oh, it must be good.
Okay, that's exactly right. What this young man is saying, this is actually a major theme of my work. And you're of course brilliant. And what you're saying is spot on. No, what he's saying is that what's happened is things have been flipped on their head. Is that far from things being banned today, and despite the fact that every once in a while you have huge public explosions about things like Janet Jackson's left nipple, it really is, people have virtually given up on the idea of banning stuff. What he is saying is that far from people trying to ban things, what we have is sort of the inverse, that people assume that if you can shake up the bourgeoisie, if you can shake up the middle-class mores, if you can challenge conventional American life, then that is something worth doing in and of itself. You're exactly right. People talk about edgy content in Hollywood. And that's precisely, by the way, why boycotts and letter-writing campaigns and angry moralistic denunciations do not work. It's often like Brer Rabbit in the Briar Patch. I mean, this is exactly what people want. People create. And, I know the people with Sin City, to go back to what I began with, are disappointed that there's no attempt to boycott them or to protest them or to serve, because they made the movie deliberately to be offensive, which is one of the reasons it comes across as childish. And you see, the other question about Million Dollar Baby versus Hamlet, the one thing about great drama, and this is true about great movies as well, is moral complexity. Most great art is not didactic. Most great art is not there to teach you a specific lesson. There is a difference between art and propaganda. Propaganda can be artistic, but it is very rarely great art. Part of the problem is that we have lost that distinction to some extent, and again, been too willing to honor material that, quote, shakes things up. The fact that something shakes up or offends middle-class sensibility doesn't make it unworthy, but it certainly in and of itself does not make it worthy. The point is that when you go to consume media, and let me conclude with this. First of all, try to consume less. Real life really is better than life on screen, if you'll allow it to be. But secondly, do keep in mind, messages matter. Anyone who is pretending that a commercial, a half-hour TV show, or a feature film is message-free is lying to you. Every element of a feature film, from the costumes to the set design to every line of dialogue to the camera angles to the lighting, it's all argued about and agonized over and planned very deliberately. Try to understand that it's not just a diversion. It is also something that does enter your consciousness, has an impact, and should be evaluated not just on its style, but on its substance. Thank you very much for your attention. Have a wonderful weekend.